kindly will connect you to a network of people who will listen to you and help you out with whatever problems you might be facing. Users can choose categories like addiction recovery, marriage divorce, work business, and the app will connect you with the right listener by a text message or even a phone call. Many of the listeners are psychology students. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, and this is the Marketplace Morning Report. This is APM, American Public Media.
Banner ads on blogs. Oh, you guys, that is so 2012.
However, in the last several years, brands and bloggers have been partnering together a little bit more on sponsored content.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Oh, joy, the economics of a blog about style and design, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace tonight at 6:30 here on WAMC. Support for Marketplace comes from Scott Alarm Systems. Licensed security and fire detection available with or without a phone landline, monitored by a 24/7 local central station for commercial as well as weekend and full-time residential customers. ScottAlarmSystems.com. NEDC Warren County, working with communities in the Adirondacks, Lake George, Glens Falls, and Queensbury, providing existing businesses and new businesses with resources for growth and expansion. EDCWC.org. And I want to thank you for tuning in to Morning Edition on WAMC. Thanks to our engineer, Dave Hopper, to our producer, Patrick Garrett, especially to you for listening. I'm David Giustina. The roundtable is next. Have a great day. 9 o'clock.
This is Northeast Public Radio, WAMC FM HD 90.3 Albany, WRUN HD 90.3 Remsen Utica, WAMK HD 90.9 Kingston, WOSR HD 91.7 Middletown, WCEL HD 91.9 Plattsburgh, WCAN HD 93.3 Canajoharie, WANC HD 103.9 Ticonderoga, WAMQ HD 105.1 Great Barrington, WWES HD 88.9 Mount Kisco, WANZ HD 90.1 Stanford, WANR 88.5 Brewster, and WAMC AM 14. Albany.
It's Wednesday, the 13th of August. Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. In this hour, we'll start off with an open discussion of issues in the news and beyond. It's our Roundtable panel. Joining us for the discussion this morning, College of St. Rose Professor of Communications Mary Alice Mulgard, NYPERG Legislative Director Blair Horner, and Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain. Later in the program, we'll speak with Dan Barber and Elizabeth Colbert about a Berkshire-grown Future of Food event. Chris Noth will tell us about Lincoln's favorite Shakespeare. We'll hear about the Jamal Jackson Dance Company coming to PS21. Simon Garfield will tell us about the lost art of letter writing. And Mike Love from the Beach Boys will chat with our Ian Pickus. The Roundtable begins after news.
BBC News with Cathy Clugston. International efforts are intensifying to stop the advance of jihadist fighters in northern Iraq and help tens of thousands of civilians displaced by the fighting. The French President, François Hollande, says his government will supply arms in the coming hours to Kurds in Iraq who are fighting the Islamic State group. Duncan Crawford reports from Paris.
The French president says that people in the Kurdistan region of Iraq are facing a catastrophic situation. A statement from François Hollande's office says that arms will be delivered to Kurdish forces in the coming hours, although it doesn't specify what weapons will be sent. Kurdish and Iraqi leaders had already complained to French officials that Islamic State fighters are using sophisticated weapons which were looted when Iraq's army retreated.
The Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has again expressed his defiance at moves to replace him. In a televised address, Mr. Maliki said the nomination of Haider al-Abadi to replace him was a violation of the constitution and had no value. The international community and Iraqi politicians have put their support behind the removal of Mr. Maliki, who's been widely criticised for intensifying sectarian division in Iraq. The former Egyptian president Hosni Mubarak has given a passionate defence of his actions in court, saying he had never ordered the killing of protesters. Speaking for the first time during his trial, Mr. Mubarak admitted that he had made mistakes as president, but said he'd done his best to fulfil his duties.
Muhammad Hosni Mubarak, who is standing before you today, never handed down orders for the killing of protesters. I repeat, never handed down orders.
It is our roundtable panel. Good morning and welcome back to the roundtable. It is Wednesday, the 13th of August, and very nice to have you with us on this rather dreary, congested traffic anyway. Wednesday morning, but Blair made it, and that's all that's what counts. Blair's here. Good morning and welcome. You can join us roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. Let me introduce our panel to you. Blair Horner is here, legislative director of NYPIRG, also known as the New York Public Interest Research Group. College of St. Rose professor of communications Mary Alice Mulgar joins us. Is this your first time on the panel?
No.
I didn't think so.
Okay. Long time back.
So welcome back.
Thank you
very much. Very nice to have you here. And Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain. Is this your first time on the panel? No.
Mike, I'm happy to be here.
Mike, my co-host. at some point, you got to start drawing a check, Mike. Thank you very much for being with us again. We welcome your comments, roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. Let us start off with the news of the day. You know, one of the stories that I wanted to get to yesterday and we didn't, because we were talking about a lot of other stuff, but I do want to hit this story, so we'll do it right at the beginning, and that is the death of Mike Brown in Missouri. Once more into the high wire of race for President Obama, once more because a young black man has been shot dead on an American street. On Tuesday, President Obama offered a deliberately worded plea for peace in Ferguson, Missouri, where nights of unrest have followed the death of Michael Brown, an 18-year-old whose life ended in a confrontation with police. The president termed Brown's death heartbreaking and called on others, as has Brown's family, to honor his life with nonviolence. The president said in a statement issued by the White House, quote, "I know the events of the past few days have prompted strong passions, but as details unfold, I urge everyone in Ferguson, Missouri, and across the country to remember this young man through reflection and through understanding." It was thus after the 2012 killing in Florida of Trayvon Martin by George Zimmerman, who later was acquitted in Martin's death. It was thus after an earlier altercation between a black university professor and a white cop in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that resulted in the professor's arrest. So there are, so here we are again in a story like this. And some of the footage that I've seen coming out of Ferguson is very troubling. And you wonder why, in this case, history has to repeat itself.
Well, it does seem to follow a pattern, doesn't it, where there's a confrontation and someone is either severely injured or killed, and it's usually a young black man, and then there's a dispute over exactly what happened. After the case of Trayvon Martin in Florida, the president said that there are very few African-American men in the country who haven't had the experience of being followed when they are shopping in a department store, and that includes me. And you do hear that experience, you know, where young black men are, stopped for questioning and it's just a paranoia that they have. And I guess there'll be more that will come out of the investigation into this death in Missouri, and whether the policeman will be charged or exactly what happened. Hopefully those details will come out. But it just seems like it's a pattern. It just happens over and over again. And how do you break this cycle?
Yeah, just, I mean, the big difference between this case and the previous one, the Trayvon Martin case, is this happened in the middle of the day, in the street where people could see it.
Right.
Trayvon Martin.
And also police.
That's right. And it is, and so there are witnesses who have been talking to the media who describe a scene that's completely different from the way the police are describing the scene. The police tend to be overwhelmingly white in this particular area, and the community is overwhelmingly black, so that sort of plays into the race issue. There's been a history here of racial profiling that's gone on. I was looking at some articles in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on this story, and there's a sort of a history that's been where the one lieutenant of the police force was actually canned for telling the police officers to go out and arrest black men. And so you sort of have this tinderbox, which this match has been thrown on, and it's coupled with the fact that people actually saw what happened. And these scenes out of Ferguson are unbelievable because it really feels like they're on the verge of serious civil unrest, with police officers wandering around in camouflage outfits and machine guns, people going out and buying guns. There's a run on gun sales in the area, and nighttime, you know, conflicts between the police and demonstrators. It's really sort of a shocking scene.
I saw one photo yesterday that was just amazing to me. It was a now and then, a 1960s photo, Alabama or Mississippi, with the German Shepherd being held back by the police officer. And then right above it is a scene from Ferguson. The only difference between the two pictures is that the one was in color and right. the other was in black and white.
Yeah.
But you could not have told that it was 1962 versus this year.
I mean, the FBI has moved in to investigate this as a possible violation of civil rights, and that sort of gives it, perhaps it'll, give a more objective view of what happened and hold whoever is responsible accountable and identify what happened. But it does sound like what you're saying, Mary Alice, you know, that this is almost a throwback to the civil rights unrest of the 60s, and that's really sad.
The other thing that struck me was that you have so few facts now. There is the FBI investigation, there's the county investigation, the police officer still has not been identified,
because there have been threats apparently against all
right.
the police officers on the force,
which certainly makes sense. However, it does seem as though what we know is very little other than that he was unarmed, he was walking with a friend, and he was shot. And as you said, Blair, in the middle of the day.
Right.
So and the eyewitness accounts would certainly give you great pause as to what happened. I don't understand why, and I guess, you know, as this thing boils over and becomes a larger and larger issue and becomes, you know, something that the president is addressing and is making international news, that the county is being very tight-lipped. But you would think at some point there would be a defense of saying, well, this is our version of what happened.
Yeah, the other wild card in this whole thing is the hacker group Anonymous has hacked into the police department's records and have emailed out the police chief's address, his name, and have alleged to have said that they were going to do that for the other officers as well. So it's sort of taking on a life of its own. And Joe, you're absolutely right. Until the facts come out, it's really hard. It's sort of the fog of war issue right now. The combatants are out. People have the differing versions of reality. We don't really know what happened yet. The only thing that could really help right now would be a really expedited review by the FBI. The longer that this thing festers, I think the worse it's going to get.
David Klinger, a criminology professor at the nearby University of Missouri at St. Louis, according to this Washington Post article, said he was surprised that some in the community reacted so violently. Klinger said, quote, obviously there's been stuff that was boiling under the surface for years. And I assume that this is, you know, that stuff that's been boiling under the surface for years has been racism for centuries in the country.
Yeah, well, driving while black, you know,
right.
That's the thing. One of the other items I thought was interesting about this story, though, is that the witness that Blair referred to is refusing to talk to the
That's
police.
Right.
And that, I think, is just exacerbating the situation. But that also then ties back to what happens in many communities made up of people of color, is that then, you know, you get the idea that someone is a snitch and they won't cooperate with police because they don't want to get that label. So if someone did see something that happened and it's a different version, they're not going to be willing to come forward because they're going to get that label.
There's been some press reports of a second witness that's surfaced as well, although we don't know who that person is. I mean, it really does give you this feel that the population feels like they are under siege by an occupying force. I mean, when you look at the visuals, the police officer in tactical uniforms, in camouflage outfits, which seems sort of odd in an urban setting, carrying machine guns, driving around in big, armored vehicles and they were overwhelmingly white against a black community, overwhelmingly black community, and it really does give you the feel, and you can understand them why a witness wouldn't necessarily want to talk to an occupying force if they really are viewed that way. I mean, they're willing to talk to an objective observer, which would be in this case the media.
Well, the camouflage type dress that the police wear is to make a statement. And it's to give it the air of a combat scene, and it's to underscore their power, probably with the hope of trying to keep force. But it could exacerbate the problem. I mean, you have to look at the whole way that police departments react to this. I mean, we should have learned something from 30, 40 years ago, and it just seems like they're aggravating the situation by rolling through the city that way. On the other hand, there has been some violence some looting, and they have a job to do.
That's right. A woman was shot actually last night. Yeah. Although she apparently will survive. And that from the police perspective, you want to be protect yourself and sort of damp down what could easily turn into an out of control situation. I'm certainly no expert on this, but you could see why the community would feel the way it did. And the state of Missouri has this interesting law which requires, it's been in place for over 10 years, requires the reporting of all. The racial and ethnic background of individuals that are stopped by the police. And not surprisingly, you see all across Missouri that you're much more likely to get stopped by the police in a car or walking around if you're African-American than if you're white. And that statistical information is interesting, although not necessarily tells you too much other than that's what happens. And certainly if the African-American community is feeling under siege, as I mentioned before, they're going to react differently. And you can see it in the streets. It's very intense. And the only thing the FBI getting involved and the U.S. Justice Department getting involved could be very helpful because, again, it's an outside entity. African-Americans presumably would view them more neutrally than they view their own police force in this situation. And the sooner they get this thing done, the better.
We should know that the lawyer who represented Trayvon Martin's family is now representing the family of Michael Brown. When you mentioned the witness is the other kid, right?
His friend, yeah.
Who was not charged, to my knowledge, correct?
I don't
at this point
so.
No.
Yeah, and so you find that interesting of what transpired. And I'm sure much more will come out of this, but I was struck by something that you said, Blair, that the FBI investigation has to be really swift.
Yeah. I mean, they're talking about a couple of weeks too, and I think that's probably too long.
They came in quickly, yeah. Which was good. Mm-hmm. Joe, I'm really impressed by that story that you sent us a link to from the Washington Post that gave a profile of Mike Brown. He had just worked his way through, finished up some classes, and won his diploma, and he was going to go for vocational training. He was a big kid, but he didn't play football. They said, they tried to make him play football, as his parents did, because he was so large, but he was called the gentle giant, and, he was just the way he was sort of timid his whole life, it just makes it very difficult to understand how he could have been in a confrontation like that with police.
Yet many of the photos that I've seen of him, not the graduation picture, the cap and gown with the kind of glare at the camera, some of the other online photos that I've seen show him in actually quite aggressive positions, flashing what everybody interprets to be gang signs, and the oversized hat to the side, and kind of the rough aggressive look. So that's quite
a
contrast.
Sort of
the
look that people have. Yeah, no, I know. And where I was going with that was, it reminds me of Trayvon Martin, the kid in Florida who first stories came out saying what an outstanding young man he was, and then he was vilified. I'm expecting there'll be the other side of the story soon, that he was an aggressive kid, which is really. What difference does it make?
I dimly remember the days of being a young male. But they are often sort of an odd bunch of characters that like to be tough. And the hormones are raging in the late teens in particular. So it wouldn't surprise me if you have all sorts of pictures of any young male, particularly strutting their stuff at the, their seniors in high school. I'm sure they could find pictures of me doing something, maybe not the same attire, of course, because this was back in the days of tri-cornered hats and stockings when I was in my late teens. I can dimly remember those days, and that was clearly what young men are like in many cases.
We'll get to your letters and also other topics for the day. We're going to take a break and go over to NPR News and find out what else is happening in the world, which we'll be talking about when we come back. Mary Alice Mulgard, Mike Spain, and Blair Horner are panelists this morning. We welcome your input, roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be back after the short break. Good morning and welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel this morning. We welcome your input, roundtable at WAMC.org. You can also go on our webpage or our Facebook page. You can tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. And we got a lot of response from our discussion about the death of Michael Brown. And we begin with Jules, who writes, "It would have been interesting to have had a person of color on the panel this morning for the discussion of the Michael Brown shooting." We agree, and we did try, but we thank you very much. Steve writes, "The police and riot gear only appeared after the population of the area began looting and vandalizing. It isn't as if the police maintain that kind of posture day to day, and with regard to the discussion of racism simmering, no proof has been offered that racism was the cause of the shooting that started the whole thing. I'm not putting on blinders with regard to racism in this country, nor its potential role in this incident, but it is far too early to say if it played a role. Suggesting that it did, which is what many media outlets are doing, only adds fuel to the fire. With regard to Joe's statement, the threats against the police in the wake of the event are understandable. Shame on you, Joe. Such a response is never defensible. An anonymous further stokes the flames when it publishes names and addresses of public servants in order to encourage others to act violently against them. They should be shamed and discredited for doing so." Just a quick note to that. I did not actually say that the threats against the police were understandable. What I did say was when we were talking about the name of the police officer who fired the shot, his name was being withheld. I said that that was understandable given the violence and because of the fact that the addresses had been given out of possible officers. That was what I was saying and trying to get at. Ryan said, "Just so you know, oversized hats cocked to the side aren't indicative of anything. I'm a white suburban father and have a degree in history, and I wear an oversized cap cocked to the side often. It's a hat style. That's it. Let's not stereotype." I think that may have been our point, but okay. And post 9/11, police forces have obtained greater and greater firepower. If they have their military-grade toys, they are going to use them, even if the force is not in proportion to the threat. And Ryan writes in and says, "Can you please talk about the militarization of police? This isn't just about race. Why do cops need tanks and machine guns? Why do they go through military-style boot camp training? Aren't they here to protect us?" And finally, we got this from Tom, who says, "What happens when the black community realizes that the Second Amendment applies to them as well?" Want to take on any of those?
I think they express the broad perspective that people have on these issues.
Well said, Mike.
I think it's also important to point out on the militarization of police that it seems to be selectively used. In this particular case, in an urban area, I think to some extent the police have to remember they're there to protect and serve. That actually goes to both of those. You don't see the militarization of police involved in taking on right-wing militias out in the desert in the western states where they are actually pointing guns at public officials. And while I'm not arguing that violence should be, the potential for violence should be reacted to with violence, it does send, I think, the wrong message when, on the one hand, you back off from armed individuals who show up and to protect someone who's violating federal law. On the other hand, show up with machine guns looking at urban citizens with their hands raised. I mean, it sort of sets the wrong, I think, images to everyone in the public.
We welcome your comment, roundtable@wamc.org. Governor Cuomo and top New York lawmakers departed for Israel on Tuesday night to express support for that country in the Gaza conflict, but not before receiving an unexpected and not entirely welcome invitation to visit territories that Palestinians regard as part of their future state, including East Jerusalem. No time, the governor said. No thanks, his fellow travelers said. Mr. Cuomo and the legislative leaders kicked off what they called their unity mission to the Jewish state with a news conference at Kennedy International Airport, an Israeli flag flanked by the flags of the United States and the state of New York behind them. The governor said, quote, our message is simple and clear. We stand with Israel and we support Israel's right to defend itself in this conflict.
I'm not sure who thought up the idea of taking this trip, but I think that probably this is one of the worst public relations decisions to come out of this administration. Why all of the top members of this state government are going to Israel at a time when there is such chaos and conflict, it just kind of boggles my mind that they would venture to do this and risk this opportunity that clearly the Palestinians are jumping on, taking advantage. Now they can point the finger and say, well, we offered the invitation and you turned us down. I don't think somebody was thinking very far in advance.
No, you know, the idea of statewide elected officials from the state of New York traveling to Israel in election years is a well-trod path. It's certainly the fact that the governor is paying for it out of his campaign contributions.
Is he paying for the Republicans and the independent Democrats?
I think they said that they're paying for their own own campaign contributions. I think that underscores the political nature of the trip. I mean, if this really was some sort of, you know, government-to-government interaction where businesses were going to be done, then you could argue, well, the taxpayers should pay for it, notwithstanding all the optics issues that you've raised. But the fact he's using campaign contributions, I think, really just sort of like tips his hat toward really what's going on. An Israeli flag behind the governor at a news conference, flying to Israel in an election year, and paying for it with his campaign contributions. I think this sort of tells New Yorkers exactly what the deal is on this.
And they're describing it as a unity trip.
Unity with who?
Well, I think with, you know, Jewish Democratic voters in an election.
They've already got Jewish Democratic voters. They've already got the Jewish Democratic voters.
Who are they going to vote for?
Yeah.
Robbie Astorino?
There's no alternative waste.
Boiling it down to its purest, most cynical view, which may not be the case here, but it'll be my argument right now. The Moreland Commission fiasco has been dominating the news from the governor's perspective. This certainly changes the subject and focuses, I think, the optics of him going to Israel in an election year. It also changes the narrative for him across the country. I mean, the Moreland problem that sort of blew up in the governor's face, I was visiting Cape Cod last weekend, and I heard from people in California that they had heard about this. And so now—
Many New Yorkers have not, though.
they may not understand it, and dislike the governor for it. They may just put it what may turn out to be in the proper context. But that's what everyone was talking about. Now they'll get a chance to talk about the governor going to Israel, and I think from the governor's perspective, that might have been the logic for their doing it.
I agree with Mary Alice. The optics are bad, and maybe have backfired a little bit, especially with this invitation from the Palestinians to visit East Jerusalem. But the idea that he takes a stand and says, I stand with Israel over Hamas, certainly, absolutely, it's political, but you know, I think people will appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Do you want him to be wishy-washy on important issues? I mean, he is taking a stand. So here I am defending the governor on this a little bit.
Well, he could take the stand without flying all the way to Israel,
right,
though.
I mean, you can do that from right. the second floor. Right. He doesn't have to spend thousands of dollars and to—
But he's got it. Don't you see he's got $33 million
right. in his campaign fund? I understand that, but— Lord, there could be things that that money could
My guess is that we have, if we all thought about it collectively, that the path from the United, the path taken by elected officials in the United States, particularly in states that have large Jewish constituencies, to Israel in election years is probably something, you know, there's a lot of people have done it. But
to Mary Alice's point, with this much violence and this much unknown and question marks around, I mean, we're at a flashpoint, a very hot point in this right now. It seems to go now at this very week, at this very juncture, may be questionable.
And there are colleges and universities all over the country who are pulling their students out of programs of study in Israel. They're insisting that their kids come home.
Sure.
They're not going to allow them to go to Israel for the coming semester. I think that there probably should have been a bit of a reality check. Maybe postpone this until closer to the election, maybe have a little bit better impact.
Well, the question, I have not heard the answer to this. Perhaps you know, Blair or Joe or Mary Alice. Was this initiated by Israel or was it initiated by the Cuomo campaign camp? And I guess, you know, are there other politicians from other states going there? Is this a practice? I know you're right. It's a perfunctory thing for a politician in New York to head to Israel and show their solidarity ordinarily. But at this particular time, are other politicians from around the country going to Israel?
I mean, I don't know about the latter question, but the former, there were media reports at the end of July
he had reached out.
That Netanyahu had reached out to the governor.
Okay. Uh-huh. That's right.
Now, whoever initiated that, of course, we may never know, but that was being reported at the end of July. My guess is that the governor doing this is a way to help stem the loss of tourism dollars and everything else from the bad publicity of Ben-Gurion Airport getting shelled by Hamas. And so that may be, by standing with Israel, the logic of it, the obvious logic would be to say that, well, look, we made it. We went on an LL airline. We landed. Nothing happened. Everything's cool. Feel free to go back to Israel.
Well, does it hurt him politically? Does it help him politically?
It probably helps him with the Jewish constituents. Probably hurts him with the Arab American constituents, which are not insignificant anymore in the state of New York.
Just count the number of repeal the SAFE Act signs upstate, and you know he's losing people who are on the edge, people who are not quite in his camp, but maybe were thinking about it. I don't think that this helps him at all upstate. Downstate, yes. Upstate, no.
Well, that's where the voters are, I guess. I mean, to some extent, also, it puts his Democratic primary opponent, Zephyr Teachout, who presumably would be making a play for the same sort of liberal constituencies in the primary, puts her in a little bit of a box. So that probably has a fun bank shot from the governor's perspective.
The delegation also included Mortimer Zuckerman, who's the publisher of the Daily News, and the designer Kenneth Cole, who is also Mr. Cuomo's brother-in-law.
I was expecting to see Alan, actually, on the list,
yeah.
too.
Well, you'll notice he's not here.
That's right.
Yeah.
But we're not saying that.
No. We,
if you're listening, Alan,
that was a joke.
The stealth passenger.
We know where he is, and he's not there. Okay, so we're going to take a break. We'll come back. We will continue our conversation on other issues. We welcome your input, roundtable@wamc.org. Roundtable@wamc.org. We'll be back after this short break.
Support for WAMC comes from Springbrook, Oneonta, New York, supporting people of all ages with developmental disabilities, working in schools, in homes, and in communities across New York to help individuals achieve independence, springbrookny.org. Alacrity Frame Workshop, Lark Street, Albany, New York, offering custom framing and new exhibits every first Friday, open Monday through Saturday, 518-915-1956. And Bethel Wood Center for the Arts, celebrating the 45th anniversary of the Woodstock Festival with an outdoor screening of the movie Woodstock, The Director's Cut, Friday, August 15th at 8:30 p.m. on the original field, bethelwoodcenter.org.
Welcome back to the Roundtable. We welcome your letters. We welcome your thoughts and comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. There had been some thought. I said this, and I'll probably get letters on this, but I thought that, after the passing of Robin Williams, and everyone was, sort of taken aback by that the one person who had to say, oh, okay, was Tony Stewart, who suddenly went off the front pages of the newspaper very, very quickly. And I think, well, yesterday that story came back. And there were announcements that the inquiry into the death of Kevin Ward Jr. At the Canandaigua Racetrack Motorsports Park in New York on Saturday, that investigation was going to take a while. And while while law enforcement in the county said that again that they were investigating, it was expected to take. To take some time, and they reiterated what they said from the very beginning, which is that at this time no criminal charges were going to be filed. Now many legal experts and criminal justice experts are weighing in and said that those charges very well could be filed and very well may be filed and be a part of this investigation. Obviously, a lot of speculation, and but it's something that they're going to be looking into over the next several weeks. And I guess I don't know what you look into more than the tape, the cars, and the witnesses, right, Mary Alice? That's sort of a little bit of everything.
Well, and you have to understand too the style of racing, that it is an aggressive form of racing, and this is one of the key factors and elements that's going to be looked at in this case, is whether Tony Stewart's actions were part of just the normal pattern of racing or whether he did anything that was out of the ordinary. I've looked at the tape. I've seen it, looked at it three or four times myself. I've looked at some of the interviews with one or two of the other drivers, and there is some indication of some culpability that he may have engaged in an aggressive move, maybe just to startle the young driver. He certainly was not intending to run him over, but to shower him with dirt or to come close enough to intimidate him, which is part of today's racing.
Well, I mean, I think some of the legal experts that you mentioned were saying that if prosecutors believe that Tony Stewart recklessly caused the death of another person, he could be charged with negligent homicide,
right,
in New York State. And then it gets into the whole thing of, boxers in a boxing ring engage in activity that if you did it on the street would be a crime, but it's not when it's within the sport. But the actual, car to car may be covered by that rule, but a car and a person who's outside of a car, and if there was any even intent, as you said, to kind of spit up some dirt and just kind of continue that bravado, that little, dance that goes on for audience, for the audience, really. Mm-hmm. If he did, he could be charged with some kind of, reckless endangerment or something. And the case is being investigated. They're looking for all kinds of witnesses on this.
I mean, I have to admit, I'm not a NASCAR aficionado. So I don't really know. I was sort of startled by the fact that the guy jumps out of the car and walks out onto the track while all these cars are zooming by.
And that's not unusual.
That's right.
At all.
So that's inherently dangerous. If we would do that on Route 787 or the Thruway or something, people would think we were crazy. But you're right. I mean, it turns out that this is the kind of thing that they do to sort of get in the face of the person who helped contributed to them crashing. This is a way to sort of destruct their stuff. And so this may play into the Tony Stewart. Was Tony Stewart then responding? He sees Ward, and he decides to spray him with gravel. The counterargument is there was a car in front of him. The car in front of him just narrowly missed Ward. Did Stewart really know that Ward was that close.
And it's important to say that he's been fully cooperative, and the sheriff has not suggested anything other than that, you know, the sheriff of Ontario County out near Rochester. So, you know, it's pretty much up to the investigation at this point.
And it's, you know, you're on dirt. It's 35, 40 miles an hour?
About 45. Yeah.
And under yellow, so you assume they're, you know, slightly slower. And
low light, wasn't really well lit, you know.
No. So a lot plays into this, and it'll be interesting. So does he race Sunday?
If he's smart, no.
Yeah.
He probably should take the day off.
At one point, he needs to get back in behind the wheel, I guess. When that point is, I don't know.
And maybe it's at the end of an investigation.
Perhaps.
All right. Let's talk about Warren McCall passed away yesterday. She was 89 years old was... not only a wonderful actress and a screen icon, but also a terrific New Yorker. Did a lot up here in Albany and championing the arts and a lot of lobbying and that. And she passed away at 89 years old. And you know, one of those people who just seemed larger than a life. And when you watch the footage from the films, what strikes me is that it's one of those things where they show you the clips, and you're like, oh, now I want to see that whole, like,
you want to
go back and go see the whole thing. Yeah. It's really. Because there's just nobody, you know, that, and it's another one of from that era gone, which is sad.
Well, you interviewed her, right?
I did. Yeah, I've interviewed her a couple of times when she was up here in Albany, and she's, you know, an amazing woman, and had done so much, and I would say no nonsense, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's the way it appears. You know,
yeah, she did not suffer fools gladly, I think, and was very direct, but very nice, and certainly very very polite, and I found her to just be fascinating.
Brooklyn born, you know, lived in Manhattan, lived in the Dakota, you know, that's where she lived all her life.
I always admired her for taking the stance. She and Humphrey Bogart both joined a group of other Hollywood stars in the late 40s and early 50s when the House Un-American Activities Committee investigations were underway. They got on a plane, went to Washington, and really confronted HUAC in its own den and protested against the investigations into Hollywood screenwriters and directors and producers who were accused of having communist affiliations. And that was a great risk to their careers at the time. You know, they, in some of the coverage, it has said in the last day or so, you know, that you know, they may have backed off from that position later on in life, but at the time, it could have been a disastrous situation. So I always thought that both she and Bogart were pretty brave for having done that.
12-year marriage. Again, Warren Bacall passed away at the age of 89. Mary Alice Mulgard, Blair Horner, Mike Spain, thank you all very much for being with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Roundtable continues after this.